Well, on Wednesday morning, the Summit County will be attending County Officials Day at the Utah Legislature. In the studio with an overview of that, as well as some other county business, I have Assistant County Manager Jana Young. Good morning.
Good morning.
So following legislative issues is certainly one of your job duties. Wednesday's agenda, mostly that. What happens at County Officials Day?
Yes, so Summit County, along with the 28 other counties in the state, all belong to an association called the Utah Association of Counties, or UAC for short. And among other things, this group organizes around legislative issues during the session of the state legislature. They have a really dynamic and organized lobbying and advocacy team that represents at county issues among our legislators at on Capitol Hill. And each year they host a County Officials Day. This is an opportunity for our county council members, as well as other county elected officials, to actually go to the Capitol and talk about issues with other counties that are impacting our budgets, our land use decisions, what have you, as well as get some face-to-face time with the governor and the lieutenant governor, and most importantly, the individual lawmakers that represent us. We feel this face-to-face time is really invaluable. It gives us an opportunity to really flag some issues for them that we care about, as well as collaborate on some critical votes that they have to take. The other thing that is important about this is it's just good for legislators to see us and to have a presence on the Hill so that they know we care about what we're doing. We're here to be collaborators. We want to help. If we can be resources on issues that they're trying to solve or address or have to vote on. So it's a really fun event for us every year. I believe all five of our county council members will be there tomorrow, along with some other of our county elected officials.
So it's informational, but it does sound like the council does get a chance to do some lobbying here.
Definitely. We always prepare, one pager of issues that we hand out to them. They sit down and have lunch with us, so it's a good relationship building opportunity, but we definitely do talk about issues, particularly ones that are kind of the hot button ones that are moving pretty quickly through the committee process, so that we have an opportunity for them to interject some questions, to clarify things for us, or to give some opinions and positions on how we think they should vote based on the impact to the county.
Well, let's talk about some of those issues. We've got, the Medicaid expansion replacement bill, a done deal. Now that that has been approved and signed by the governor, it's too late really to do anything about that. Can you talk a little bit about how the impact this will have on the county's health department and mental health services budget?
Yeah, so a lot of the budgetary implications are still being figured out. The last we heard was that it will be about a $7 million hit to all counties, which is the lesser of the two amounts that we had heard. I believe the governor was advocating for about a $15 million cut. So we're still trying to figure out what impact that might have on us. I think that the county was pleased to see that if we don't get the waivers that the state is asking for from the federal government, then the law of the land will revert back to the Proposition 3 language, which we support. We do support full expansion of Medicaid. So it's hard to say at this point. There's still some, lack of clarity around what the fiscal impact will be for us. But we certainly are interested in expanding Medicaid while at the same time continue to provide other critical services such as drug court and our JRI program, which have been really successful within the county.
What's the JRI?
It's the Juvenile Reinvestment Initiative, and it helps a lot of with issues with recidivism among our juveniles. We have, I think, two sheriffs that are dedicated specifically to that program, and it's really affected, but it's not funded at the level that we feel it should be.
Hmm. All right, so it's kind of just a wait and see now to see what the federal government does.
Exactly. Yeah. It does sound like the bill was effective when the governor signed it yesterday. So we'll have to see. I think that's a prime example of how hard it is to follow things during the session, because things move so quickly. And, this bill just flew out of committee, and now the governor has already signed it once, the House passed it and the Senate concurred with those changes last night. So, we're only entering our third week of the session, so you can imagine how important but also complicated it is to stay on top of all of these things. Even at this point, I believe over 500 bills have been introduced that impact counties, and there's thousands more in the wings just waiting. So we certainly have to, you know, come together and try to follow everything.
Yeah, there are a handful of bills regarding agriculture. What's the county's position on Senate Bill 93, which says that it will protect farms from nuisance complaints or lawsuits?
So I believe with this bill, it's more of, you know, while we support, obviously, agriculture, UAC and Summit County did oppose this particular bill because we feel like it would limit our ability to regulate agricultural practices and nuisances associated with those practices. One provision in particular states that if an agricultural practice was at one point in time in compliance with county regulations, but then the county enacts a new ordinance prohibiting that particular element, causing the practice to fall out of compliance, then this bill would invalidate the county ordinance and allow that nuisance to continue. So always with these things, at the end of the day, the county's most interested in health, safety, welfare, and our ability to make those local control decisions. And so that's really what it comes down to for us.
And when we talk about nuisances, are we just talking about the smell of manure?
It could be many things. I think we're most concerned about the public health implications. So if there's if they're not properly mitigating the manure or whatever, and we have a fly problem, or you know, it's contaminating our groundwater, things like that that are really a concern for us.
Let's see, House Bill 180, this establishes a process by which a person may challenge a legislative body's rejection of a proposal to create an agricultural protection area. I believe Summit County and Utah Association of Counties both oppose this. How come?
That's correct. Well, it's interesting because it's currently a legislative act to create a protection area, but then this bill would allow for a petition process to create that agricultural or industrial protection area if the legislative body denies it. So then the petitioner can go to court and get that decision overturned. Additionally, it would also prohibit our ability to regulate the activity that occurs within that area. So similarly to the issue we discussed just before, it comes down to us still being able to regulate things that we feel impact the health, safety, welfare of the county.
All right. And then there's House Bill 216, which governs standards on food from the farm. The county also opposes this. How come?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would invalidate, again, local regulations on farm-to-table activities that occur in an agricultural protection area, regardless of health, safety, and welfare concerns. And that's an issue because if consumers are going out and purchasing this food or product, they expect that it's good. You know, it won't make them sick or whatever. So that's why it's important that our health department and others still be able to get in there and regulate those operations.
So it sounds like it would deregulate that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm. Okay. let's see. House Bill 119 would institute changes for the initiative and referendum process. Improvements or more problems?
So this is an interesting, you'll notice there's actually a number of bills that address the initiative and referendum process this legislative cycle. This particular one, HB 119, is actually one that I think we're supportive of. UAC and the League of Cities and Towns are working directly with House and Senate leadership to modernize the referenda process. They've been instructed to find ways to make it easier, as well as more consistent and fair and easier to understand. And so we don't know the details of a lot of what's in that bill right now. They're still negotiating a lot of the pieces of it, but there are three key categories they're looking at. One involves process and timing of the overall referenda process. For example, right now, the county clerk has to consult with the petitioners or proponents of the initiative after they've already collected their signatures. And so sometimes they'll find that that particular item is not eligible for the ballot. And so after they've already spent all these man hours to collect signatures, then they're told they can't put it on the ballot. So the timing of this would allow us to have those conversations up front and also allow the petitioners to appeal that decision in court up front. There's also the area of the threshold in order to get items on the ballot. How many signatures do they need? And then also the communication between residents and elected officials during the referenda process. I believe some of the folks working on this feel that our electeds should be able to voice how they vote on a particular issue while not diving into the realm where they're actually advocating for or against it.
Yeah, and I guess what we're hearing is that there's legislation that would make it more difficult to collect signatures. You'd need more signatures, and you'd need to collect them in less time, which is, it's already difficult to do it as we've got going.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a couple bills out there that do that, although we're told that 119 is the one that will move forward because that's the one leadership supports. And so certainly our effort in this is not to make it harder. And it sounds like those discussions are being very fruitful.
All right. House Bill 257, sponsored by Phil Lyman, concerning counties' ability to change their form of government. I guess this doesn't affect us since we already have.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I mean, we've kind of heard that. I got confused on which one this is. So yeah, that's correct. It really only focuses on 4th through 6th class counties, and Summit County is a 3rd class county. So regardless of our change recently, this won't impact us. I believe it's an effort to help the rural areas to have a form of government that they feel is workable, and that's the commission form. However, I know that our county has feelings about this. I mean, honestly, we believe that it should be left up to the voters to decide what form of government that they would like, especially at the local level. So it's definitely something we're engaging in the conversation, but we're not actively advocating or opposing it.
All right. And then House Bill 99, this allows counties to be indemnified on fire cost. And I mean, is this potentially opening the door to creating fire roads through forest areas?
You know, I'm not sure I'm familiar with that particular bill.
Okay. And then there was another bill being sponsored by our representative, Logan Wild, House Bill 288, which is looking to take away land use authorities. And this has to do with Draper, but I mean, it could impact any county.
Is this his Greenbelt bill? Or?
I don't know. I just know his House Bill 288. Okay. Anything else that you wanted to mention?
Yeah. There? I mean, I just wanted to, I know there's been a lot of talk about these big issues impacting the legislature, but what we haven't had a chance to talk much about are the proactive issues that Summit County is working on. One in particular is a bill that Logan Wild is sponsoring for us that addresses a very critical public health, watershed, and economic property rights issue. And this is the issue of failing septic systems we have within the county, where we really should bring sewer into those systems. As people know, Summit County is home to the headwaters of 5 major watersheds that provide critical drinking water to our community, but also to many communities across the state. And so when we are in these areas where these systems are failing, there's a big concern that they will contaminate that water, which will be disastrous for us and the rest of the state, especially with the growth that's expected over the next couple of decades.
Okay, anything else?
Oh, I guess that's it. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, hey, thanks, Jana. Yes. Park City Planning Commission tomorrow night will be considering a plat request for residents at the Tower Condominiums at Empire Pass. As part of that approval, it's an agreement between Park City and the Empire Pass Master Owners Association to provide funding for historical structure rehabilitation. In the studio with details is Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this agreement is part of the plat approval. How come?
Well, there's a couple things going on here, and I just want to send out whatever appreciation I can to the public and the museum for making sure that our feet are held to the fire on this one. This is really why we do public involvement. So anyway, back in 1999 and again in 2001, there were a couple of technical agreements between the developer, which at the time was United Park City Mines, and the city for historic preservation and open space. Over the course of time, there's been a number of determinations about whether they're in compliance or not or what we should do about it. Finally, when this particular project came up, which is unrelated to United Park City Mines, a completely separate project, it was time to get all the way down in the dirt and figure out what's going on. So Redis, which is the successor to Wells Fargo, which is the bankruptcy successor to Talisker, has come to the table, and Story Development has come to the table, which is the developer of the Talisker Club at this point. And they've offered to have the Master Association take responsibility for all the mine sites and what we call Technical Reports 5 and 6, which is open space and historic preservation. And it's a fairly good number. For the next 10 years, the Master Owners Association will contribute $20,000 a year or in-kind services for preservation. Plus, there are separate agreements with Redis and with Storied that are in negotiation right now for the $65,000 for the Little Bell mine sites to go back to the museum for the restoration of that, and funding for putting a roof back on the Judge Mining and Smelting building. So it's a significant number. It was a hard negotiation. Except for a couple of family problems this week, we were expecting to have the document signed. The Planning Commission will review it. It'll come back to the Planning Commission, then it has to go to the City Council. The city will participate in part of this using our share of the open space management fee that's part of the development agreement. So it's very technical, but unbelievable performance on the part of the city attorney's office and the two parties to the agreement.
So what's the annual obligation then?
$20,000 a year, the city's share, we get 1% of all the real estate transactions, or half of 1%, as part of our open space and management fee. And so a portion of that, or $20,000, will go as our share to historic preservation.
Okay, you mentioned in-kind. Is that just for the city's contribution?
No, actually, Empire Pass has staff. They have backhoes. They've got other equipment. So if we need to restore some of the signs for the museum, if we need to do revegetation, if we need to do site cleanup or graffiti removal, they have staff on site, and we're willing to consider staff contributions.
All right. So this basically takes care of any of the outstanding issues of non-payment.
I'd like to tell you that. The way the agreement is structured is we have 6 months to figure out who exactly is responsible for some of the things that are undone. At the time, it was negotiated completely with the mine company. At this point, some of the sites are no longer owned by the mine company and may be owned by other entities. So the Daly West headframe is owned by Jordanelle Special Service District, which is completely independent from any of the agreements, but it's a very important community icon in that neighborhood. And so we're trying to figure out who has responsibility. In 2001, there were certain agreements made that are probably not appropriate for 2019, like on the Judge Mine site as an adaptive reuse. There may be a better use of restoration money than adaptive reuse in that location because we don't have a road. We have a gate. You know, we got a couple other things going on. So we have 6 months to clean that up, which is similar to our agreement with Park City Mountain on their historic preservation. We will not permit any additional subdivision or other types of approvals with Redis, which is the successor in interest, until this agreement is completed. So Twisted Branch will not move forward, or if they push a separate subdivision plat forward, we won't approve that either until this is done.
Okay. Is this expected to be approved?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Unless something bad happens in the next 24 to 48 hours, we have an agreement in principle. It's just a matter of getting the signatures in place, and the City Council needs to take action so that the city can sign the document.
All right. The Bureau of Land Management taking public comment on some of the sale of land here in Park City, about 5 1/4 acres of some isolated tracts of public lands. I think we're talking about the property there on Deer Valley Drive. What can you tell us about that?
Yep. This is the next round of issues on Rossi Hill Drive and on Deer Valley Loop Road. A number of the parcels are already zoned open space. The Rossi Hill neighborhood wants us to see us do some additional open space zoning in that location. And we're comfortable doing that, but it's going to take a request from the neighbors to do that for us to move that action forward. Heinrich Dieters has responsibility for the BLM because planning department is in kind of a regulatory role. We are a little bit of a firewall away from all of this. But Heinrich and I have been meeting, and the neighborhood has been meeting with us and with Heinrich on how to do the open space. This also relates to the historic house that's being redeveloped and the three historic houses that are not being redeveloped at this time but will be redeveloped going forward. And that's what we call the Dennis parcel. And we made it almost a year ago. We changed the zoning from a higher density residential medium density to historic residential low density on that parcel, and that will allow some development and either redevelopment or reconstruction of those three historic houses that are remaining.
Yeah. So who does that redevelopment then?
The Dennis family could sell that to a developer, but then they got to get through us. So it could go to a developer. I don't believe the Dennis family is in that business. So there are folks that are looking at the parcel. We would allow additional density in order to encourage the restoration of those three historic houses. We would not allow development in front of those houses and Deer Valley Drive.
At one point, the city was interested in the property for affordable housing, so no longer?
Not that I'm aware of. That one hasn't risen to the surface for a while. I think there's other pieces that Community Development Director Laurent is looking at.
Let's talk a little bit about the Kimball Special Event Space that was opened for Sundance. How did that go?
Planning was out most nights with the sound meter and inspecting sites with building and the police. We have no complaints. However, it was just the inside space, not the outside space. In order for them to use the outside space for an event or an activity, they need to come through us for a permit. We're processing that permit now as an administrative act. But the conditions of approval will not be significantly different than what it was when it was a full conditional use permit. So we're taking a look at it. Planner Newberry is handling that, and I would expect we'll issue a permit in the next 60 to 90 days. But the conditions of approval remain the same, the sound meters, the noise meters, no tents, some of the other things that were in the previous action.
All right. Let's see, the sale of the Colin Lumber building there on Heber Avenue to Talisker. The plan is to keep the main level restaurant open to the public, but that could change?
No, not according to our information. There are two levels. One is the bar down on the plaza level, and then there's the main Colin Lumber. The main Colin Lumber on the street is subject to our vertical zoning and our conventional change business ordinances. That has to remain a public restaurant. The downstairs level could change over to a private club offsite, which is kind of a geeky term. At this point, there's no application for them to do that. So that lower level needs to be open to the public, and there needs to be availability. If they choose to do preferential seating for their club members, that's okay. That's no different than any other sort of restaurant, given their good customers first seating when there's a line during Sundance. But at this point, we have not seen an application. They've asked us about it. We said, you guys got to get a permit, and it's going to take us a while to do it. I think there's some questions about how successful pure private club offsite restaurants can be, especially during the off season. So it may be that they continue to leave their restaurant open for the public. We believe it's in the best interest of the historic district to get that space up and running and get that plaza working again and get that lower level bar working again and get Colin Lumber working again. It could be pretty cool, assuming we can get our permits correct.
Yeah. The city, though, does have an interest in avoiding having a bunch of private clubs on the in the downtown area.
We do. Yeah. Absolutely we do. That's why they're prohibited in storefronts, which is 8 feet above or below the street level. It doesn't contribute to vibrancy to have too many private clubs out there. On the other hand, if we've got some difficult spaces like the lower level that have never been really successful, let's give it a try.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I'm all set. I appreciate it, Leslie. We made it through Sundance. We made it through FIS and no major issues.
All right. Bruce, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Park City Planning Director Bruce. Well, Park City is holding its first standalone State of the City address this evening. The event intended to inform the community about the city's accomplishments and to look ahead to the upcoming year. Joining us now with a preview, Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and thanks for having me in.
Yeah, so you had mentioned earlier that you thought this might sound a bit pretentious. Yeah. If so, why are you doing it?
Well, really, we've been trying to get creative about how we do community engagement the last couple of years, and we started out with coffee with council and au pair events. This summer, we did some barbecues and an event at the farm, and we've got some fun ones on deck where we might do an event on bikes or an event on buses this spring. But we thought doing a State of Park City might be a good way to have a midwinter celebration and engage the community. So this is more about having a party and a celebration and a forum for everybody and just celebrate our successes and talking about what we should do next.
Okay. You'll be addressing the city's four critical priorities: housing, transportation, energy, and social equity. Anything in particular you want the community to understand about those priorities?
You know, we'll be just touching on everything. We're not going to go into a whole lot of depth, but each one of those items, we have a few initiatives that we just completed or we're looking at doing that we're going to talk about. In particular, we're going to highlight we have a new transit goal. There's been a lot of talk over the years. We have a very straightforward energy goal to be net zero by 2030, housing goal of 800 units by 2026. But transit, we had about 60 different metrics we were using, and that's hard to communicate and understand. So we're going to roll out our goal that we agreed on at the retreat, which is a 25% reduction in traffic on our entry corridors. That's about 5 million fewer cars by 2030. And if we're successful at this, this will take us back to about 2003 levels on our roads.
Which we don't remember. But
I remember it was better.
Let's see. So the first half of the address basically featuring your remarks, right? I mean, so and then a Q&A session with the entire council?
Yeah, we actually have a video montage we're going to do for the first part of it, and that's I narrate that, but all of council is involved as well as some of our staff. Then I am going to make some remarks on some critical priorities. We're going to make some mentions and honor some individuals in our community and the good efforts they've done to work on our community critical priorities. Going to talk about three new initiatives, just some fun stuff that we're going to be doing in 2019, concluding that with the last initiative, which is Love Where You Live. And then we're going to shift to a Q&A with council.
All right. Any topics that are off limits?
Absolutely nothing. We'll talk about anything. And I also want to mention, though, after we fit, you know, the first hour will be the forum element. And then after that, we're going to break out into round tables and we're going to enjoy pie and talk about community issues or whatever anybody wants to talk about. We'll have a council member and hopefully a planning commissioner at each seat and gather around with community members and eat pie and ice cream.
So who made the pies?
Those are coming from June's Pies out of Heber, and then ice cream's being provided by Wasatch Creamery.
Okay. Can we, anything else that you wanted to mention to that? I guess we should say at 6 o'clock tonight, Jim Santee Auditorium.
Exactly. And I believe it will be broadcast on Facebook Live by the Park Record. I believe KPCW is doing a live broadcast. But I really encourage people to come out. This is going to be more fun to be there, and you certainly can't eat the pie online.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the council last week meeting for 2 days for its annual retreat, discussing again the critical and top priorities. Are these conversations helpful? I mean, what we had heard is like, oh, it gives the council an opportunity to take a deep dive. But it seems that in some cases, you got so much into the weeds that you were distracted from the issues at hand.
I don't think so. I think sometimes you got to get into the weeds and then pull out of the weeds to get where you need to be. And it's very difficult in a council meeting where any given meeting, you've got 6 to 20 different topics you have to discuss in maybe a 6-hour period. This allowed us to spend 2 to 3 hours on each of our critical priorities and deal with some of the more difficult questions. And I tried to summarize those in conclusion and make sure everybody was in agreement at the end of our discussion periods. And I think we did make some progress. Particularly, we had some difficult questions in both housing and transportation that we really wanted to get firm guidance from council. We certainly, as we talk about these, sometimes we think we know what the community wants and we think we know what council wants, but having some time to dive a little deeper allows us to crystallize that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the housing. Again, as you mentioned, we've got a goal of 800 units mm-hmm. by 2026. I think we've got about 19 of those built with what? How many in the pipeline?
We had 39 come online if you combine our private efforts and our public efforts this year. That's the Park City Heights project as well as the 19 units the city built. What's become clear is we have a pipeline and funding for about 500 units. Combining the requirements by private industry with the big base redevelopments at the resorts and some other projects going on, along with city projects, which will add a couple, hundred towards that 500. It'll be about half and half, I think. The last 300 units is a little bit elusive, and that's councils trying to figure out how to fund those, where they would be located. Those are a little bit murkier, and that's what you're going to see us focus on the next couple of years as we move forward with all these current projects.
Mm-hmm. There was also some talk about where these units get built. I know that it was, are we committed to having these units in the city limits, or are we going to expand it and look at some partnerships out in the Snyderville Basin or, Summit County?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons why we're doing this. And if I had to summarize it, it'd be about community building. It'd be keeping our middle class and our essential service workers in the core of town to help fortify our community. Because as we know, we're really trending towards second homes, and it's becoming hard to have the integrity of a neighborhood anymore. So that will remain our first priority, is to build units in the core of town where people don't need cars, where they're close to where they work, and they can be active community members. But there are major needs, and there may be opportunities to partner regionally with, say, Summit County or Wasatch County or one of our nonprofits like Mountain Towns or Habitat, and do a project around the boundaries of town. And council, we ask them that question straight up, because there's been discussions in both directions, and they said they want to focus on building units in the core of town. That's our priority, but we will remain opportunistic should the right partnership pop up near our boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So other than the Woodside Park area, is there any other property that the city owns on which you could build?
We have several. So we have two phases on Woodside. We've got about 2.5 acres there. And then we've got the 2.2 acres at Homestake we plan to build on. We've got the 5 acres for the Arts and Culture District. We plan to put actually a fair number of units above the nonprofit spaces and some artists in residence there. And then we also have a large piece of land over near Iron Horse and Fireside called the Summer Parcel. And that's one we could do a significant project on. And we're looking around. There may be some other opportunities that pop up.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, you're looking at designing projects that are carless. And I guess mm-hmm. that would have to be if, in fact, that you hope to reduce 5 million vehicle trips off the roads here in a few years.
Yeah, that is one thing. With an aggressive transit goal, we're going to have to get very innovative and creative. And it often comes up, are we willing to build projects with limited parking or no parking and deed restrict them in a way that people can't own cars or can't park their cars on site? And that's something council's looking at. It's difficult because we need to have a system in place where it's a car optional town, meaning you can get around town seamlessly without having a car before we ask that of people. But if we don't start building the town we want to live in, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, it's difficult, though. A lot of people have two jobs, and it is difficult to not to have a car to get from job to job.
Absolutely. And we acknowledge that. And, cars are also a big expense and they're a big hassle in a town like this. So we're trying to build very efficient, very affordable properties with low utilities and the possibility you don't need a car.
Councilmember Peake brought up the issue of the responsibility of the resorts in providing housing for the workforce. You said it wasn't the right time to have that discussion. How come?
I think we've got a commitment from the resorts that they're willing to have some discussions on that after the season. Certainly they were in the middle of World Cup, so it's not really fair to talk about them without them at the table. Frankly, I think the resorts, although there's a lot more they could do as the town's biggest employers, there are a lot of other big employers in the town, such as the city and the schools and a number of our large hotels, that also need to step up our game. So I think it's a broader conversation that involves all of our employers in town. And one of the interesting ideas that Councilwoman Gerber brought up at the retreat was maybe we ought to do a co-op project of some sort, where we partner with some of our smaller businesses in town and allow them to invest in a housing project for their employees, since they don't have the critical mass to do their own projects.
Mm-hmm. There was also some talk about the city's responsibility for employee housing and including the city's employees, again, as one of the largest employers in town. So how does that work? They're just like any other employee?
I think so. I think it's really important quality of leadership, both personal leadership and organizational leadership, to blaze the way and never ask of others what you're not willing to do yourself. So I brought that up with council and said, if we are going to ask our largest businesses to step up their efforts on housing, we can't get off the hook. Even though we're building housing for the community, that shouldn't necessarily count towards our requirement to provide housing for our own employees.
And so, I mean, what does that mean specifically?
I don't know at this point. I mean, I think if we were to reach out to the large businesses in town and say that we feel like they need to provide 15% or 20% housing for their employees, I think that's something the city should be ready and willing to do ourselves.
And that wasn't the case when we approved, like, the Woodside Park. I mean, as a developer, were you required to
that's where these get... They're multifaceted and tricky. At this point, I think I'm just bringing up the intention that we need to be cognizant that during the winter, we employ almost 700 employees at the city. So we add to the problem of the need for workforce housing, and we should be part of the solution. What that looks like is a much broader conversation, and that's why I said we should circle back and have it at a later time.
All right. Also, beefing up public transit and active transit systems, a big part of the transportation conversation, making it safer for pedestrians and cyclists to get around town and jump on a bus. I think the simple takeaway is that the city needs to, everything needs to be more accessible. So, I mean, in terms of what steps we take to get there, I mean, what are we looking at?
Wow. I mean, since we made a transportation a critical priority, we've continued to say there is no silver bullet. It's going to have to be addressed on a bunch of fronts. And active transportation was one of those. Walkability, bikeability, the way for people to get safely around town. We've got some great corridors in, but we have some big holes. We've got areas that we need tunnels, we need curb cuts, we need better paths, we might need segmented paths. Those are all things we need to look at. And we did that with the walkability bond. We've got some money held aside to finish up our Kearns project, which the Jan to Dan's, which is badly needed. But after that, the money's spent. So the question we posed to council was, do we need to dedicate some of our funding towards active transportation as well as buses and the other areas? I think we do. I think it's a big part of our culture, and it's an area where a small investment goes a long way.
So what is the Jan's to Dan solution there? Because we had talked about having some kind of under...
Yeah, the idea was to put a tunnel across there. And, it's been very complicated because there's a tremendous amount of utility infrastructure under that road. When 248 gets redone in a few years here, we're looking at that with UDOT right now. I anticipate that'll probably happen 2021, 2022. At that point, when we have the road torn up, we'll do the tunnels and connections we need to do over there. It just doesn't make sense to spend... It's going to be very expensive, so to spend the money now and then tear it up and redo it in a few years just doesn't make sense.
And one of the things the sustainability team asked council was if they could reach out to other communities about the city's efforts to be net zero by 2022, right?
Our city operations by 2022, mm-hmm. And then community-wide by 2030. And yeah, this is something Park City's efforts make us feel good, but alone they're not going to impact climate change. So we've always felt like we can serve as an example to other communities, proving that it's practical and scalable. And I've been saying lately, where the Green New Deal comes to life here, we're actually doing it while it's just being talked about in other places. And we've already had some impacts. Salt Lake joined us on our goal when we set it a few years ago, and most recently Mayor Biskupski committed to match our 2030 goal as we lowered ours. Moab has joined on board. Summit County has made similar commitments. And we think we're influencing other towns, and we want to continue to focus on that. And council said they're supportive of that, although they don't want it to overly distract from our internal efforts. We need to strike a good balance.
Okay. Anything else, Sandy, that you wanted to mention?
Leslie, I just want to thank the town for their patience and good spirit. The last couple of weeks, it's been a hard push with all the events in town, all the snow and such. And I welcome them to come out and celebrate with us tonight. It's supposed to be fun.
Yeah. So can you give me a preview then of the three new initiatives? You mentioned Love Where You Live was one of them.
Yeah, Love Where You Live is one of them. We're also going to provide a new resource to residents. And I'm gonna keep that one a bit of a surprise to give people a reason to come out. And then the third one is we're going to be aggressively installing electric infrastructure for electric cars, charging stations. So we're going to make an announcement on that.
Okay. Andy, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
It's Park City Mayor Andy Bierman again. The council is the State of the City address happening tonight, 6 o'clock at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Pie following. Don't miss it. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:59.